The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Good morning. I want you to know that it being Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day, I can't think of a more appropriate thing to be doing on Yom Yerushalayim if you're going to be in America. In other words, understand that really we should be taking a walk now through the alleys of Jerusalem, in the old city. But if we're in Nebuch, in the mountains in Connecticut, I can't think of a more appropriate thing to be doing. You know, truth is a very challenging thing. And a little bit of truth can actually become very false. It's very difficult to get to the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And I learned this most of all from my children. There's a script that we find ourselves in regularly in my family. It usually begins with Adi. Adi is our third. She's Baruch Hashem 5 years old. Thank God she's healthy now. And she usually comes running in, something to the tune of, Abba, Abba, Yair, hit me. Right? Now, of course, this is a very significant moment. And everything must stop. And negotiations have to begin. And the first stage is to discover, of course, why Yair, who's our three-year-old, hit Adi. And so very quickly you usually discover that it's because Adi hit Yair. Only, of course, Adi neglected to tell you that. Now, Adi didn't say anything false. She just wasn't telling the whole truth. She was picking that part of the truth that sort of applied to her what she felt was valuable. So that becomes a very interesting challenge. And it's amazing just how many half pieces of truth can occur in 5 minutes between two children under the age of six. And how differently they can see the truth. And how challenging it can be to arrive at the truth. And how confusing it can be to try to put all those different pieces of truth together. And I want you to know that this is really what gave birth to the idea of this retreat. Because more and more, you know, over the last, certainly the last 6 months since I've gotten to America, so as much as, you know, I love Israelite, and thank God Israelite is doing many amazing things in America, obviously what's going on in Israel has very much shaken us all. And so any opportunity that I have, that we have, that Israelite has, to do something for Israel, to speak for Israel, to speak on behalf of many of the different organizations, some of which you'll hear about over the next few days, that are in need of support in Israel and support of Israelis, victims of terror. And so it really amazes me to confront some of the questions that people have. And I hope, God willing, at the end of the class we'll have a chance for questions. And one of the things that most challenges me is that people legitimately are very confused. What's going on? How did we get here? What is there to do? And I want you to know, if you have a particular solution in mind, if you think there's an answer, it doesn't matter whether the answer is right or the answer is wrong, at least you have an answer. And if your answer, you think this is what's supposed to be. And I remember when the fighting began, sometimes it's more challenging when you know or think you know what the answer is. Because when that isn't occurring, that becomes very challenging. I live in a place called Ephrat. It's in the mountains just south of Jerusalem. Breaks my heart to tell you actually that we're probably not going to go there during the week that we're in Israel. Plug, plug, plug. Only because we wanted to set up a week where everybody would be sort of as distant, despite meeting some of the people involved, from the issues, so that people will feel comfortable. But at the end of the trip, we're going to have a few optional days, and God willing, then those of you who decide to come along will get a chance to see Ephrat, I hope. But there was a road that was built to the south of Jerusalem. You probably heard about it in the news. goes right beneath the suburb of Yerushalayim, which is called Gilo. And very early on in the war that we're in, Palestinian shooters started opening up towards Gilo from Beit Lechem, from Beit Jala. And you have to understand the geography. Beit Jala basically sits up on a hill. The tunnel road, there's a road that goes through a tunnel, it's the longest tunnel in Israel, goes straight south to Efrat and to Gush Etzion. And Gilo sits right over here. And these two hills sit on top of this road. And as the crow flies, the distance from Beit Lechem to Gilo, right, from Bethlehem to Gilo, to the suburb of Jerusalem, is about 1,300 meters, 1,300 yards. So 1,300 yards and a heavy machine gun makes for a party in certain circles. And this became very challenging. And the army tried all sorts of things, and what was especially difficult was that anybody who was on a commander level up understood immediately. You take one look at this road, you take one look at what's going on, and you understand it right away. We were called in, I was drafted for over 40, almost 40 days, driving my van nuts, because every day, you know, we were talking, I would try to get in touch with them, and we had all this work to do, and he would say, when are you coming? And I was, I have no idea. And we ended up doing a lot of, you know, different fun sort of things along this road. And on the third night of the war, so we got called into brigade headquarters, all the battalion commanders and the staffs of the companies, and we got a briefing from the brigade commander. And when he was finished with the briefing, basically intelligence, what's going on in the area, what we have to look out for, what we have to do, new policies. So he sort of started speaking from the heart. There were no reporters, no tape recorders, just a bunch of commanders talking. And he said, I want you to understand what is challenging me. This is a brigade commander talking. I want you to understand what is challenging me about this whole situation. He said, what's challenging me about the situation is that I know exactly what we have to do. I know exactly what the solution is. The solution is we have to take back Beit Jala. This gunfire will not stop. And he explained it to us on a map, and he's absolutely right. When you look at the breadth, the width of how much fire is coming towards Gilo, how many different hilltops, how many different areas, there is no way to protect that road and the southern edge, eastern edge of Gilo, unless you take back that hill called Beit Jala. And by the way, the people who were living in Beit Jala actually were Christian Arabs. They had no interest in gunfire coming from the neighborhood either. But for various political reasons, that wasn't done. And it took a long time, until about 2 weeks ago, until they finally did it. That's very difficult. And every military commander I've met, way up the line, they all have the same solution. So what do you do? What do you do when you know what the answer is and you can't do it? That's one type of challenge. But I want you to know there's a deeper challenge. The deeper challenge is when you have no idea what to do. When you have no idea what to do. When you realize that you're in a situation that there really is nothing you can do. I sent out a weekly Parsha Byte this week, but because I was doing the mass email, you probably didn't get it. God willing, you'll get it next week. And I won't tell you the whole story. I'll just whet your appetite. But the first time that I actually ever came under fire as an officer was a really strange story. And we were doing a patrol, we were actually doing an ambush, we were in the middle of Lebanon on a hilltop, and we were overlooking a valley, and in the middle of the night, they opened up on us on one side, and there's a whole procedure that you do, and you return fire. And at this point, basically, your position is blown, because you're on an ambush, you're trying to sort of spot infiltrators coming in the middle of the night. About a minute after they opened up in front of us, and you don't know the distance, because it could be, it's night, you can't tell distances. So what you do when you're fired at is you just immediately set up in a line. You know, you call out to your six as your first sergeant, and you all sort of come together. Then you do what's called a makateesh. You fire into the darkness. And then you stop and you wait, and if the firing keeps on, you do it again. And right as we finished our makateesh, we're firing into the darkness, and all this gunfire in front of us, all of a sudden they opened up behind us. Now I want you to know this is an incredibly terrifying thing. And they teach you what to do. And they ingrain this into you in officer's course. And they actually teach you that when you're out in the field, don't wait for something to happen. Try to imagine all the different scenarios that could occur. Right? In fact, it's funny, because I'm not sure whether I learned how to put this skill to use in Talmudic study in the army, or whether in Talmudic study in Yeshiva I learned how to put this skill to use in the army. But it's the same idea. You look at a text, and you rip it apart, and you try to imagine every angle. And that's what you do in the field. And they tell you, don't wait, when you're walking on patrol, imagine what would happen if. Well, if I was attacked, what would I do? Well, I would use that ditch as cover, and I would maybe do a sort of a pincer movement around those trees, and I would lay down my flank over there, and then you walk another 100 feet. You can't do that anymore, because you can't run back to the ditch. So you do it all over again. So you're lying in this ambush, and it's incredibly boring. It's not like the movies at all. In the movies, it's great because there's music, there's tension, and the whole ambush only takes 90 seconds because that's all you have until the guys get there. But in real life, this is the third night we're doing this, and your neck is on fire, and you're looking out in the valley. So you've been thinking through, what would I do? What would I do? And you pick the most remote possibilities just to imagine what you could do. And thank God when it happens, you've already decided what you would do. So as soon as they start firing behind you, you immediately split your unit in half. That's what they teach you to do. Half the guys, four of you, keep firing forward. The other half of the guys turn around with the first sergeant, and they fire backward. And then they opened up on our right. And a minute after this, they opened up on our left. We were completely surrounded. It's the only time I've ever experienced this feeling. I want you to know, it goes into the pit of your stomach. And we had to pull off this hilltop to a ditch that had sort of I had seen on the way up. And we called the battalion, and they sort of started figuring out what they were going to do. This whole story ended up taking only 2 minutes, but you'll have to read the end in the Parshabite. But I want you to know, there's a moment where you experience, you fully understand that there is nothing you can do. But you have no idea what to do. You're eight guys in the middle of a valley in Lebanon, surrounded by the gunfire by hundreds and hundreds of men. There's nothing you can do. You don't have any idea what to do. And that seems to be the situation that we find ourselves in. If you ask the average person, Israeli, Jewish, American, by the way, Christian evangelist who feels for Israel, all of them, what do you do? So some people will say, crush them! Everybody, sort of understands instinctively that that might be an interesting experience. The people who have to do that have a little less appetite for it, because you understand, of course, what a price you have to pay to do such a thing. But nobody really thinks that's going to solve the problem. That's just going to deal with the symptom. So some people say we have to negotiate. Well, that's ridiculous. What are you negotiating with? So what do you do? Can it be that we don't know what to do? So I want you to understand that part of that challenge is not only what do we do, but do we understand how to represent what these possibilities are? Sometimes the issue is not knowing what to do, but at least knowing what is wrong and what we shouldn't do. And what challenges me the most is how many Jews I meet who aren't even aware of the issues that would allow us to reach whatever conclusion we reach. Take a look at this board. There's a jumble of numbers on this board. Just by raise of hands, take a look at this board. Okay? Can you see the numbers, more or less? Okay? How many people in this room recognize every number on this board and know exactly what it signifies? Every single one. Pardon? Okay, I'll read them. 70, 70, 13, 20, 63, 67, 56, 14, 92, 48, 00, 1,000, 93, 586, 17, 135, 67, some of you might recognize already what this is a collection of, but does anybody recognize every date on this board? I'll tell you what, I'll take off one because it was really nasty. That's this one. That's just the year I was born. I threw that in just to see. But if you look at all the other dates, can you recognize what every date are? Let me ask you a question. How many dates up here? 14 dates. 14. 14 pieces. Okay? I want you to know if I did this in a different way, people would think they were phone numbers. How many people here chop at least 10 of these? At least 10. Look around the room. Now think about this. That's amazing. We're missing something. We're missing something. And I want you to understand what the challenge of this particular discussion is. There are two ways to teach a class. And they're both reasonable, acceptable, maybe powerful. Most often what happens, a teacher finds something that he really connects with. A text he really loves, an idea that he's become imbued with. And he wants to share it. And because he loves it so, and he shares it, then he connects with whoever he's sharing it with, whether it's with his family around the Shabbat table or no. Sometimes, though, it's not that the teacher teaches something because he loves that idea. Sometimes the teacher connects with something that he understands people need to hear. And so when we were planning this retreat, and I was speaking with Rabbi Aaron, And Bayan felt that there was a need for a sort of an overview. You know, a perspective. And that's why we call this the mystery in the history. Because it's an interesting question. How did we arrive here? How did we get here? I mean, the question, the challenge that seems to be put forth again and again and again. Do we have a right to be here? When I say here, I don't mean in Connecticut. Do we have a right to be in Yerushalayim? Do we have a right to be in Israel? Is there grounds to support the claim of the Jewish people to that land? And most importantly, which is what challenges me, can I do this in any environment and in front of any audience in the world? Now, don't get me wrong. Just because a person can't defend an issue, or just because a person doesn't understand, or can't put into words why he knows something to be true, doesn't mean it isn't true. That's not the issue here. If I asked you to prove, you know, I mean, just as an example, I need a bold volunteer here. Do you know who your mother is? Describe your mother to me. Don't get me wrong, I'm married, Baruch Hashem. Describe your mother to me.
5 feet tall.
5 feet tall. Looks like you. So she's got auburn hair.
Lights up the room,
okay. So I want you to understand something. You don't really know that that's your mother. I mean, you think that's your mother. You don't know that that's your mother. For all you know, your real mother gave birth to you. And 2 days after she gave birth to you, she took one look at you and said, forget this, and dumped you on a bus stop. And the person who says she's your mother came by and picked you up. But never, she doesn't want to hurt your feelings. And of course, everybody else is here is laughing. But the same statement is true of everybody in this room. You don't know who your mother is. You think you know who your mother is. If I asked you to prove, I mean, has anybody here done genetic testing to show that this is your mother? And even if you could do genetic testing. So we don't know. We can't prove it. No, no, hang on 1 second. But that's ridiculous. Of course this is your mother. You know it's your mother. So don't get me wrong. I don't want anybody to misunderstand. I don't want you to think that this issue is about whether this is right. Because things that are true and things that are right are not about whether I can prove them. Okay? In fact, I would venture to say that this is probably one of the principles on which Israelite is based. It's one of the things that I fell in love with about Israelite. You know? That it isn't into proving anything. I'm not into proving to anybody here that God exists, that Hashem exists. It doesn't mean that I don't know that Hashem exists. I know many things that I can't prove. I know what love is. I couldn't prove it to you. It's ridiculous to try. So don't misunderstand the discussion we're about to have. It's not about proof. And we're going to get to this at the end. What it is about is my ability to respond. Now, the response in terms of the practical issues of the day, so that's going to be more for Sunday morning. First, I want to understand an entirely different topic, which is how did I get here? How did I arrive at this impasse? What am I doing in the land of Israel? I want you to know an amazing thing. This 2 summers ago, there's a camp called Camp Stoned. Not Camp Stoned, Camp Stoned. It's a summer camp. It's called Camp Stoned. It's a beautiful place. They invited me there for a couple weeks to be the camp rabbi, whatever you call it. It was an opportunity to take my kids, to give them a little horizon broadening. It was actually the summer before the whole war broke out. So I didn't realize what a bracha vacation it was. And in the middle of summer, they're only about 2 hours from Niagara Falls. They went to Niagara Falls. This is a very innovative camp. And the director, a fellow named Yehuda Ruffner, decided that even, you know, when they go to Niagara Falls, the Jewish camp, he wanted to make it sort of an experience. So they first in the morning visited a place called Grant Island. I don't know if anybody here has ever heard of Grant Island. Right? Grant Island is an island. It's about, with the surrounding land, literally almost half the size of the state of Israel, which does not say much because the state of Israel is not that big. But this island was actually proposed. It was bought by a Jewish fellow, a philanthropist, this oldest land, and he wanted to make it the state of the Jews. And as a matter of fact, it came up in the Zionist Congress in 1899 or 1898, and it was a suggestion to bring all the Jewish people there to have it become an autonomous region of Jews, like the 51st state in America. And I want you to know, they took all the kids there, and they had this whole discussion, and they had this whole question, shouldn't we have made this the state? Do you want to make this the state? If we could make this the state? Amazing discussion. The challenge, you know, our daughter, who was then 10 years old, was really sort of challenged by this idea. And of course, Yonatan, who was about, I don't know, 6 or 7, so he said to me, boy, man, did we make a mistake. Did you see all the water there? I mean, unbelievable. But of course, that is the question. What am I doing in the land of Israel? What am I there? How did I get there? And of course, the first step in understanding why we need Israel and how we relate to Israel and what Israel means, which hopefully will be a discussion you'll get into with Rabbi Aaron this afternoon, is the history of how we got there. How did we arrive at Israel? And I want you to know this is a very challenging discussion for me, because usually when we learn together, so I like to take a text and explore it and come up with a message and a theme and an idea. But I think that given the current situation, what's going on in Israel, what's going on in the Jewish world, this is so important, so crucial for every Jew to be able to understand that it's worth having this kind of a discussion. And I want you to know my goal with this discussion is very clear to me. If you can walk away from the next half an hour with the basic understanding of the historical claim to the land of Israel, just a basic understanding, and maybe even a desire to learn and to study more about it, which is so easy, then this will have been worthwhile. Now, of course, the first question is, where do you begin? Where does the story start? Where or who were the first modern Zionists? And I want to know, this is a very challenging question. I was once asked to give a class on the Zionist enterprise. And I was struggling with the same question. Where do you begin? How do you begin the story of Zionism? Well, you say, okay, so maybe you should start with 1967, which is when we really realized the dream of an entire state of Israel, including Yerushalayim, the city of Jerusalem. Today is the anniversary of that day. 1967, the Jerusalem Brigade encircled the walls of the old city of Yerushalayim, came in through the Lion's Gate and through the Zion's Gate, and in 3 days, the Jewish people, after 2,000 years of dreaming, came home. We say it every Shabbat. And my family's custom is actually to say it in every Yerushalayim. Those of us at our table sang it. Shir HaMalot. Hayinu Kechomim. The song that we sing before the grace after meal. We were like in a dream. When you think about it, you know, many of us in this room grew up with the idea of Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel. But for 2,000 years, that was a dream. Ka'afikim b'negev, the line says. We will come back like the water rushing through the valleys in the desert. You come with us to Israel this summer. And you come up to En Gedi. And you sit in the valleys, in the middle of the desert, as the streams of water wash over you. Amazing. And you can see the hewn clefts in the rock from the flash floods that pour out of nowhere. I remember I was once, when I was in officer's course, so they had this routine. They put a tremendous emphasis on navigation, right? Navigation. And, you know, the idea makes a lot of sense, because you have to know where you're going in the army. And there was a whole drill that you would do before you would go out on a navigation. You had to memorize the map and learn your coordinates or whatever. And there were a number of things that you had to do, and one of them was that they would give you a code word. You would do a tadrich, sort of like, you know, they would gather all the guys together, get in a big horseshoe, and the officer in command of that night's navigation would tell you all the rules and regulations every day, you know, got so you can do it by heart. And one of them was that if a certain code word comes over the radio, or if a flare of a certain color is fired in the air, day or night, that you have to immediately run for high ground, and you have to get 10 meters above the bed of the valley if you're navigating in the valley. Because there might be a flash flood. And if there would be a flash flood, you know, so we're in the winter, but you know, we're in the desert, down past the Sferimon. Every time we would do this, they would tell us this. You would have to climb up a hill 10 meters, which may sound like a little deal, but when you got your gear on and you're on navigation, and it's the middle of the day, it's hot. So, you know, you struggle with this, but fine. So one day we're doing a navigation, we're in the valley, in the sort of bedrock of the valley, and in a dry stream bed, and we get this code word over the radio. So it's ridiculous. And we were actually sitting right near, sort of, there was like this sort of, I wouldn't call it a straight up cliff, but it was a, like with ledges. And it would be a difficult climb. So my buddy, you know, we were doing navigation in pairs at the time, so he says, this is ridiculous. Let's just, you know, let's just stop here, nobody around. We'll wait, you know, 10 minutes, and the code will come clear, and then we'll keep walking. And this way we can get ahead of our time zone. Now the problem is that sometimes, you know, well, there's two problems. One is unethical. But, officer's course, right? But the other problem was that, you know, there were always rumors going around that sometimes they would send a jeep out, and they would, like, be on a distance, and then they would sort of be from a hilltop, they would, you know, give over this command, you know, get up the high ground. Then they would watch the two cadets they happened to have in their sight just to see if they did it. And of course, if you got caught not obeying a command, that's it. You were finished in officer's course. So I told the guy, I said, listen, you know, we've been breaking our backs 3 months already. We're struggling with this. I'm not blowing officer's course for a 10-minute climb, but you're welcome to stay down there. It's up to you. It was fine. So we climbed up on top. Of course, once you get up on top of this ledge, sweating and groaning, then it's great. Because now your time clock has stopped. You have to run a navigation within a certain amount of time. So you have like 20 minutes to relax until the oil career comes. So you pull out your sunflower seeds, you sit down, you relax, you know, it's beautiful. And we're sitting there, and all of a sudden I hear this incredible sound. It started something like this. It was like, can you hear that?
Yeah.
And it started getting louder and louder and louder over about 10 seconds. And all of a sudden, we were sitting above this sort of narrow stream bed. From around the bend came roaring this wall of water. I had never, and have never since, seen anything like this. I mean, the power of nature. The water must have been probably about as high as these spotlights up here. Just a wall of water. I remember, and you can see this if you walk in the valley stream, you know, the dry stream beds of the, you know, of the Negev in the southern desert, and I'm sure this is true in America in the desert, right? You can see uprooted tree trunks and boulders thrown around, but I never understood this. There was a tree trunk that was being swept along with this water. And it was, then it was like now 6-10 feet below our feet. And we were just watching this in absolute utter awe. And this lasted for about, I don't know, half a minute, and then the water started to go down. Until after about 5 minutes, it was sort of just water in the valley. And eventually 20 minutes came. Of course, this obviously had not been a drill. By the time we got back to the stream bed, it was almost dry, because that's the negative air. Of course, if we'd been sitting in that valley, I would not be here talking to you right now. But that's what the verse says, Ka'afikim ba-negev. It will come like the water pouring through the stream beds in the Negev. Maybe that's the beginning of Zionism, when we came home to the Six-Day War. Maybe it's 1948, when we declared the State of Israel. Despite seven Arab armies announcing that they would push us into the sea, despite the pundits' opinion, we were outnumbered in most places 15 to 1. There were 6,000 Israelis killed in the independence war. That's more than all the wars combined. We lost almost 8% of our country in 1948. People don't realize this. The standing army was nothing. We were going to be pushed into the sea. This was going to be the shortest-lived state in the history of the world. And the Jewish people come out of the shadows of Treblinka and Auschwitz, made a home for themselves. Amazing. Maybe that's where you start Zionism. Maybe it's 1917. In 1917, Lord Balfour, who was then the British Foreign Secretary, declared that His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment of a Jewish home in the state of Palestine. So not only were we dreaming about a state of Israel, actually one of the mightiest empires on the face of the earth had decided that this made sense. And there were certain moments like this in history. It's interesting, by the way, that after World War I, the Treaty of Versailles, when they split up, you know, sort of the world, the original land set aside for the state of Israel was 5 times the current size of the state of Israel. And it included all of Jordan. But that's a discussion for Sunday. So maybe in 1917, I want you to know Jews danced in the streets. Of course, today Jews don't even know what 1917 was. Maybe it was 1881. Does anybody know what happened in 1881? Pardon? Nope, that was actually 20 years later. In 1881, the Tsar Alexander was assassinated. Okay? And of course, they were always looking to blame somebody, because you couldn't blame the Tsar, he was dead. So at the forefront of many of the isms in Russia, communism, socialism, were Jews. So of course they blamed the Jews. And there began a series of state-sponsored pogroms. Now what's a state-sponsored pogrom? Basically what happens is there's a sign that's hung up on the office of the local commissar, the police chief, you know, in town. And he says basically, well, next Wednesday from 4 to 7 in the afternoon, I'm not going to be around. And, you know, please don't do anything naughty because we have to be away in our conference. And everybody understands that this is the afternoon they get that fun. And so, you know, the Jews knew a pogrom was coming, but of course, what could they do? What to do? What are we going to do? Go to the next town. They had one there scheduled for the next morning. And where could you go? And things went from bad to worse. And hundreds of Jews were being killed, and the Jews finally decided enough was enough. And there began, over the next 30 years, the most massive emigration of a Jewish population in the history of the world. 2.2 million Jews left the eastern pale of Russia and migrated. 1.8 million of them ended up in America in 30 years. By the time we hit World War I, in 1913, just as an example, in New York City, in 1880, in the census, there were about 80,000 Jews. By the end, actually, of World War I, in 1920, when there was a census taken, there were almost 2 million Jews. That's amazing. And what's interesting is that while the rushing roar of Jewry, that for whatever the reason did not stop and stay in Germany, even though most of the shipping companies left from Bremen and ports thereabouts, almost as though the Jews understood instinctively that this was not the place to stay, which may well be the reason why there is still a sizable community of Jews today after the Holocaust, there was a trickle of Jews that began to come home to the land of Israel. This was the first wave of Aliyah. This was the foundation of the birth that later became the state of Israel. The Yishuv, the settlement, HaShomer began, Jews guarding Jewish settlements. Maybe you have to go back further. Maybe go back to 1513. Somebody know what happened in 1513. 1513, there was a little old rabbi by the name of Rav Yaakov Beirav. I won't go into the whole story. He was perhaps the greatest rabbi of his day. And you can't say that about many rabbis. You couldn't come up with a rabbi that half the Jewish people would agree is the greatest rabbi of today. You have trouble finding a rabbi that any one Jew agrees is the greatest rabbi of today. But there were times in history where we were so blessed, and this was one of them, Rav Yaakov Beirav. Rav Yaakov Beirav, you can tell who he was from his students, Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, who wrote the Lachat Dodi. Rav Yaakov Beirav believed that the Jewish generation that had witnessed the expulsion from Spain, 250,000 Jews that were expelled, that were forced out of the borders of Spain and into Portugal and later from Portugal. And by the way, 1492 began a series of painful expulsions, which really only ended in 1948 with the birth of the State of Israel. Don Yitzchak Abarbanel marched 80,000 Jews over the border into Portugal, but they were exiled from Portugal 10 years later. In fact, if you look at the European continent, it's really a who's who list of who didn't expel the Jews, of who expelled the Jews. Just about every country, England, France, everybody expelled the Jews. Rav Yaakov Beirav believed that the generation that had witnessed this was worthy of the coming of redemption. And therefore he felt it was time to come home. That's why I drink water, not coffee. It was time to come home. And of course, when he came home to the city of Tzfat, the city of the mystics, in the hills of the Galilee, I want you to know you haven't seen a sunset until you sit in the hills of Tzfat overlooking Meron. Yes, we'll be there this summer. And Rav Yosef Karo followed him. Rav Shlomo Alkabetz followed him. And you could walk down an alleyway in Tzfat in 1520 and you could hear a few Jews schmoozing, you know, having a discussion. And one of them would be Rav Yaakov Beirav, and one of them would be the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo. The Jewish people believed that there was a celestial being that came to teach him Torah. In fact, after he died, they published posthumously a collection of the writings of the Beit Yosef of Rav Yosef Karo, which supposedly he had learned from an angel. Now, I don't know what you do with that idea. I will tell you that the Torah that's in that book is angelic. But it speaks to the fact that the Jewish people believed that such Torah could only come from an angel. They don't have legends like that about you and me. You know what I mean? Amazing. Rav Shlomo Alkabetz wrote the Lachat Dodi, the Ariyah Kadosh, the greatest mystic of the last 500 years. And so many more. All of them hanging out in the same street corner. Can you imagine? When the Jews got wind of the fact that all these great rabbis were coming home, there was almost a stirring. You can see it between the lines of the writings of that generation. Jews began to say, maybe we need to come home. And the first drops that would later become the trickle, that would become the stream, that would become the roaring river. So maybe that was the beginning. Or maybe it was the Ramban of Moshe ben Nachman. You know, he's not really our picture of a Zionist. 1267, he lands in the port of Akko. He was the, again, greatest rabbi of his day. The Ramban, by the way, believed that all mitzvot that we do in the exile are only in order to remember how mitzvot are supposed to be done so that we can fulfill them in the land of Israel. Didn't believe you could really fulfill any mitzvah out of the land of Israel. It's a whole different level. Rav Nachman of Breslov once said, you know, he came to Israel basically for a weekend. It was the first mission. And he came back, he went back, he touched foot in Eretz Yisrael on the soil, and he felt he was a new person. He told his students to get rid of all the Torah he taught before he was in Israel. He wanted to teach them all new Torah, because it was nothing now that he'd been in Israel. So Ramban landed in Akko, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, in 1267. It took him almost 3 months to get to Jerusalem, because he couldn't find anyone to go with him. There had just been a war, the Mongols had invaded, the Crusaders only had two ports, Akko and the enclave of Yerushalayim, and so he had to go through enemy territory as a Christian, not a rabbi, can you imagine? It took him a year and a half to get from Spain to Israel. It's amazing. A little old man with a white beard, a rabbi and a donkey, going through medieval Christendom Europe. And he talked about a trip. Maybe that was the birth of Zionism. Maybe you have to go all the way back to the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. I mean, you look at that 1,000 years, the compilation of the Talmud in Babylon. The Gemara of the Talmud has stories of rabbis, Aramaic sages, who would go up to Yerushalayim, who would go up to Israel on foot for days. And when they would arrive at the border of the land of Israel, they would literally roll in the dust in fulfillment of a verse that speaks of the love of the Jew for the dust of the land of Israel. Such a beautiful Talmudic text. I mean, I imagine, you know, sort of walking by and seeing the rabbi doing this and wondering what's off. But the love of Zion, or maybe it was the period of the Mishnah, the oral tradition. I mean, Rabbi Judah the Prince in the year 200 CE, who compiled this entire work and speaks of the love for the land of Israel, the sanctity of the land of Israel, the dream of returning and rebuilding a state of Israel in the year 200 CE. Maybe it was the fighters of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. You know, in the year 70, it looked like the dream had finally ended. The temple was in flames. The state of Judea was in ruins. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were dead. Hundreds of thousands more sold into slavery. The mightiest empire on the face of the earth had stamped its heel into the vision of a Jewish independent kingdom. The last vestiges of the rebels against the Great Revolt had snuck and slunk away into the hills and the deserts. The revolt would finally end 3 years later in Masada. So one would think that that was the death of Zionism. And yet 60 some odd years later, the fighters of Shimon Bar Kokhba, student of Rabbi Akiva, revolted against that same empire, and it made a lot of sense. I mean, after the first temple was destroyed, 70 years later they came home. So maybe after the second temple was destroyed, 60 some odd years later, it was time to come home, or this time it wasn't going to be so simple. Despite overwhelming odds, they refused to give up. Amazing concept. Where does it all begin? Maybe it began actually not with the end of the Second Temple, but with the beginning. I want you to know what happened around about the year 516 before the Common Era, 2,500 years ago. After the temple had been destroyed and we were in exile for 70 years, and prophecy had ended, there was one last righteous king of Judea. His name was Zerubbabel. And he came up with Nehemiah to the land of Israel, and they rebuilt the Second Temple. Now, I want you to understand, this is an enterprise that had never, that had never occurred in the history of the world. The nation had been defeated, crushed, scattered, exiled, and had come home. And that happened when we built the Second Temple, which lasted for 500-600 years. Maybe it was actually the dream of the building of the First Temple, built by Solomon, dreamed of by David. Maybe that's why for 3,000 years we've been calling the city of Yerushalayim the city of David. Maybe it began when Joshua, 250 years before that, before the period of the Judges, crossed over the Jordan River. And I always think, when you read in the Bible the depiction of the crossing over the River Jordan, you know, it's this magnificent description, until you get to Israel and visit the Jordan River, which is why we're not going to visit the Jordan River, we'll just drive over it. You could jump over the Jordan River in most places. As a matter of fact, I'll never forget this, I once saw an amazing sight We had taken a group. We were actually down by the Jordan River. There was some traffic. So I said, let's go there. We walked down the Jordan River. And there was this whole sort of evangelist group. And they were doing, you know, whatever they do, a little baptizing. They were collecting, you know, they had bottles. They were collecting holy water from the Jordan River. And I noticed we were standing sort of further up, and I told the group not to go down. I wouldn't disturb them. And I looked upstream about 200-300 yards, and I noticed that there were some Arabs. And they were like fishing, you know, in the river. And one of them was like, you know, Nebuch, urinating. And he's urinating into the river, and they're kind of collecting the water 300 feet down. And that's my image of the Jordan River. Almost as though God is saying, I want this to be an event you remember, even if the place isn't memorable. Or maybe it was Moses. Maybe Moses was the first Zionist. Goes back to Egypt. Tells the people, we got to go home. Went home. Maybe it was Abraham. Abraham. Abraham who comes onto the world with a whole new idea. But for whatever the reason, God tells Abraham, not here. Not in Mesopotamia. Lech Lecha. Go there. Go to the land that I will show you. How do you connect to this whole story? And what does it all mean? And what do you do with it? So I want you to understand that there are two issues here. One is, does history support our claim to the land of Israel? You already know my opinion. And the second is, does that matter? Does it matter? Do I need to know the history? So I want to tell you maybe a little piece of what this history is and why it's so important. But then I want to tell you why it doesn't matter. There's an interesting idea. And the idea comes from the Talmudic discussion of Bava Metzia. It's a tractate. And it says that when a person loses an item, okay? So, the question is, does someone else who finds this item have the right to it? Because if I lose, last night you saw they stood up on the, you know, somebody lost the digital camera. They lost it, right? Finders, keepers, hey, right? So if you lose something and I find it, do I have the right to keep it? So there's a concept, and the concept is called Yeush. Yeush means hopelessness, desperation. And actually, in order for me to acquire something, the original owner has to have given up on it. If an owner gives up on his object, then essentially that's the same as suggesting that it's no longer mine. It becomes what's called hefker. Anybody can take it. Okay. So if I lose a dollar bill on the subway in New York City, so I give up on it. I give up the subway. No one's going to run back after a dollar bill. Well, most of us wouldn't, right? If you do, you can see a man later. But, you know, no, right? So if I find a dollar bill on the subway, it's a public place. There's no sign that marks it as any individual. I can assume that the person who lost that dollar bill gave up on it. Yeush. And there's even a halachic discussion as to whether I and when I can assume yeush, this desperation, which allows me to acquire ownership. So one is the nature of where I find the place. The other is the nature of the object. And the third is the amount of time that must have transpired since it was lost. If I find it in such a public place that I can assume that anybody would have given up hope on it, such as Times Square, then I can assume it's mine. If I find it and it's the type of object that has no visible signs, in other words, I can't point to a place that it was found that would make it obvious that the finder is really, sorry, that the person claiming it later, it really belongs to him. Or I can't point to an item on the object. Like if you find an Israelite t-shirt at an Israelite retreat. Right? So you can't prove it belongs to him. You could smell it, maybe that's a sign, I don't know. But, right? So if there's no sign, and of course the third is the amount of time, technically, halachically speaking, if 30 days transpire, you can assume a person had yeush, that a person gave up hope. But if 2 years later, somebody shows up and says, listen, you know that wallet you found with a distinctive cutting on the side, and the initials, I don't know, MF, that's me, Morty Fidel, that's it. Right? Freudian, I have no idea. So this is very interesting. There are then two questions. The one is, we, who clearly were in the land of Israel, we lost it. We lost the land of Israel before we left it. Because we weren't with it. Did we ever give up hope on it? And do we have any signs to demonstrate that it's ours? And I want to understand these two ideas. And they'll lead me to the third, and with that we'll end. Did we give up hope on it? Think about this. For 2,000 years, every prayer that has left Jewish lips has been about Yerushalayim. Every time we walk into the home of a mourner, somebody in pain, what do we say?
as we get up to walk away, Hamakom yenachem otcha betoch shayev leitzion b'Yerushalayim. May God comfort you among the mourners of Zion in Jerusalem. When we grace after meals, uvnei Yerushalayim echa, when Jerusalem will be built, when we stand under the chuppah, and a couple is at the height of their joy getting married, what do? We take a glass, we put it on the ground, and we break it. I always say that's the last chance that the groom ever has to put his foot down. But understand, you have this moment in the midst of your joy where you want to remember the pain of the loss of Jerusalem. Jerusalem! Who is from Jerusalem? Who knows from Jerusalem? Jews in Poland in 1593 are breaking glasses about Jerusalem. They've never seen Jerusalem. Mind-boggling. Jews who were buried all over the world, who couldn't get to Israel, would nonetheless try to acquire a little bit of dirt. Remember when I was a kid in high school, so we used to volunteer, my brother and I, we used to go to Roosevelt Hospital. And they would give us these, you know, like Shabbos afternoon to visit patients. And they would give us, you know, like sort of the older patients who had never nobody to visit them. And there was one woman, I remember, Malia Rausch. It was a heartbreaking thing because she actually had a son some few hours away who never came to visit her. And she was in the hospital like 6 or 7 weeks. So after she left the hospital, she was going back to where she lived on the west side, and she lived alone. She had no money to afford help. So we started taking care of her, and we would go, like, you know, Erev Shabbos and bring her meals and all this sort of thing. And we became very close with her, and she had all these pictures on her wall of all these hadassah dinners. She had done a lot for the state of Israel, whatever. And never, now she was on her. And I remember I was going to Israel, and I was going to be learning for the year, and I had to say goodbye to her. And I didn't know if I'd see her again. You know, she wasn't well, and she was very old. And I asked her if there was anything I could bring her, because I was going to be coming home from my, you know, brother's bar mitzvah. She told me an amazing thing. She said, "I want you to bring me some dirt." Can you imagine? "I want you to bring me some dirt." "Well, that'll be cheap. I can afford that. No problem." She said, "I want you to go to Yerushalayim, to the Mount of Olives, Har Zeitin." She said, "I supported the rebuilding of the graveyard in Har Zeitin. Could you bring me some dirt from the Mount of Olives? Because when I die, I want them to put it in my coffin." Can you imagine? For 2,000 years, Jews couldn't get to Israel, so they brought Israel to them. In everything we did, in everywhere that we were, in all that we dreamed, in all that we said, everything was all about Jerusalem. And there's so many more and more examples of this. So we never gave up hope. Has there ever been a nation that had such a connection to the land of Israel? Did anybody else mourn for the city of Yerushalayim? Fast? Cry? Rip their clothing in pain for 2,000 years? Every year, without fail. We never lost this dream, and we never gave up hope. So we have no Yeush. This object was never lost to us. Do we have simanim? Do we have signs? I want you to know two things, and I wish I had time to expand on this, but you know, time is limited. But I will tell you two very quick things. First of all, technically speaking, you probably don't need a siman, a sign, within the framework of Jewish tradition, because this is land. Land doesn't have the same rules as an object. If you lose your land and you come back, all you need to demonstrate is chazakah, that there was a time that you lived there, and then the onus of burden of proof is on somebody else. But leave that aside for the moment. So what are the signs? It's an amazing perspective. And by the way, just so we're clear, I'm not speaking about whether anybody else could be in the land of Israel. I'm right now speaking about whether we have a claim, because it blows my mind to realize that there are Jews walking this earth who don't understand what a connection we have, and that this land is our home. I'm not speaking about whether it could be somebody else's home. We'll talk about that on Sunday. But understand. You know, there's a beautiful verse from Isaiah, Yeshayahu. Vayasen midbarak eden, arvotak egan Hashem. I will make its desert like the Garden of Eden. You take a drive down by the Dead Sea into the desert, and out of nowhere, you see magnificent orchards of date trees, palms, fields of fruit orchards. And you can't imagine how these things are growing in the desert. You know, Nachmanides, the Ramban, has an amazing perception. In last week's portion, Bechukotai, we read some of the difficult things that will overcome the Jewish people in the event that we're forced to leave our land. It's another discussion. And one of them is, V'hayta ha'aretz shomema, and the land will become desolate. The Ramban Nachmanides suggests this is not a curse, it's also a blessing. Because what this means is that until the Jewish people come home to their land, this land will remain desolate. Now I want you to understand that Ramban was writing this, seeing it, in 1267. This remained true for 2,000 years. The Christian conquerors who came in the Crusades for 100 years desperately tried to create an agricultural system that would work. Nothing worked. Nothing grew. Mark Twain comes to the land of Israel at the end of the 19th century, calls it a barren wilderness, a desert, full of Bedouin and wild animals. Why would anyone want to live here? And only a few years later, when the Jews began to come home, the land began to flourish and to bloom. You look around the land of Israel, I want you to know, and you see the fulfillment of 2,500-year-old prophecies. It's an amazing perception. And you know what saddens me? You know who really knows this? The Christian world knows this. You sit in the old city, you know who comes? The Jews don't come. We have handed Yasser Arafat an amazing victory on a silver platter. We don't come. But the Christian evangelists, they all come. I was at the rally in Washington, and I got on a train after the rally, and there was a fellow wearing a priest's collar carrying an Israeli flag. I thought, wow, this is amazing. It's amazing. What a wonderful thing. So I went over to him, and I introduced myself, and I said, you know, I just want to thank you for coming. He said, oh, it's so great. You know, you are the chosen people. He gives me this whole thing. He said, you know, his wife and he came up from Oklahoma. Oklahoma. And they wanted to demonstrate their love for Israel. Now, this is a very challenging issue for other reasons, but, you know, and now we're emailing back and forth. Now, I'm wondering whether I'm going to get a different kind of email one of these days, but that's a different discussion. And I told him, if he comes to Yerushalayim, let him come up on the roof of Israelite and see. They get it. And he says to me, you are the fulfillment of a prophecy. And he's right. But we're not comfortable with that. Ooh, prophecy. I want to live in the rational world. So understand. And now I want to tell you one last thing. And what I wanted to do here really was to plant seeds as food for thought. I want to tell you one last thing, which is that everything I just said, that it's very clear that historically the Jewish people have been in Israel, have always been in Israel. That within the nations of the world and the community of nations, that we have a claim to the land of Israel. That we never gave up on being in the land of Israel. And that, by the way, we have no problem living with others in the land of Israel. Certainly every Jew has the right to say, this is my home. But that leaves us with one last question. So what? So what? So historically, you have a right to the land of Israel. Big deal. Let's say that I could prove to you that historically, this is our home. Now, don't get me wrong. I think this is a beautiful place. But wait until December and see if you want to stay in this home. Have a nice day. Yes. So historically, we should be there. Great. Have a good time. I'm going back to Scarsdale. Who cares? Why do I need to be there? What is that all about? And I want to understand when this really hit me. You know, when you get to the airport, we're just about to end. When you get to the airport, in Ben Gurion Airport, it's very interesting. You get off the plane and you walk down to the tarmac, right? Now, you don't do that in most airports. And I hope that never changes. Right? Most airports, you land in Kennedy and you walk through, you never see the ground, right? We were down in Florida this year. My wife keeps telling me she has a real problem. She can't handle the ground there. My wife is a whatever, that's a whole discussion. She has a certain side to it, it's very spiritual, but and yet very cynical. And she's interesting balance, right? So when she says something like this, it really makes me think. Because she's not like, you know, she keeps me on the ground. You know, if I had married my wife, I'd be up in Stormo Kabach Tutti Frutti Land. You know what I mean? And my wife is like, okay, very nice, come home for dinner. You know, so we have a good balance, right? And she says she can't walk, like walking, it took her a while just to walk on the grass. And you look, by the way, at the ground in Florida. How many people here live in Florida? Do you know that your earth is dirty gray? It's like gray dirt. It's like from swampland. You've never experienced dirt. You don't know what real mud is. It's gewalt. In Israel, you walk, you know? And it's earth. So you get off the tarmac in Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel. Remember once we ended up in Pittsburgh for a year. It was quite an accident. And it's another story. And when I came back home, and I didn't realize when we were going that I was going to end up being there for a year. My mother-in-law got sick. So when we came home, I was so overcome by emotion when I got off the steps that I actually got there and I kissed the ground. And I got up, you know, and it's like, it sounds all very nice, but it's like an oily tarmac, you know. So my wife was like, yeah, great, right? And I still have people looking at me. Do you know that's why they do that? The reason why El Al makes sure that people walk down onto the ground is that when you land in the land of Israel, you should feel the earth. We have a connection to this land that is different. When God says to Abraham, Lech lecha, me'artzecha, leave your home. You know what he says to him? It's an amazing line. It's an amazing line. We're going to study this afternoon, I think. He says to him, he says, Kasher diber Hashem. Go to this land that I will show you as God has spoken to you. That's a very strange line. God is speaking to Abraham and says to Abraham, I want you to go to this land as God tells you. Well, I know it's as God tells me because you're telling me this and you're God. I mean, if God's talking to you, you know it's God. And maybe that's the secret. Maybe part of the idea is that the only reason that we're there is because of something we can't define. Now, it's an interesting question. Do you believe that there is a person somewhere in this world who is yours? That there's a person that you're meant to meet. You may not know it in advance, but God willing, everyone in this room, B'ezrat Hashem, this year should find the person they're looking for, and we should have a huge mass wedding in Yerushalayim. It'll be gavalt. It'll be great. Oh, yeah, you got a good idea for that one, huh? You have to get to Israel first in order to do that, but okay. Right? You come on a mission, yeah. Anyway, so could it be that there's a person somewhere in the world that's yours? That's the love of your life, the person you can build a home with. And I'll tell you a secret. If there is such a person, and I do believe that that's true, I certainly believe it's true for me, you start to realize, once you're married for a while, that you could never really be who you are if you hadn't met this person. And that's true, by the way, for all the people in your life, the close friends that you have. You can never be all that you can be unless you find the people that you're meant to be that person with. So I want you to know that if that's true with another person, it's true for a land. Every nation has its place. And ours is Israel. And the relationship we have with Israel isn't about the historical proof. It's not about the strategic understanding. It's not so that we'll have a place to go in the event of. It's a relationship of love. And what God has been telling us for 2,000 years is that I love you so much that I want you to know that there is a land that loves you. And there is a land that you can love in a way that you can never love any other land. And if you want to become as a people all that you can be, you need to be in that place. Because that is the place where you will become all that you can be. And I want you to understand it's that simple. The first Rashi, the first comment of Rashi in the Torah is so amazing. Rashi says that the Torah begins in Genesis, Breshit. God created the world. So Rashi says, why does the Torah begin with Breshit, with Genesis? With the beginning of the creation of the world. Why does it start with Mitzvot? The book of Mitzvot. He says, because one day the nations of the world will come and they will say to you in the land of Israel, listen, Matem, you are thieves and you have taken land. And you will say to them, this land is mine because God gave it to me. Now this is incredible. Because Rashi of Shlomo Yitzchaki is writing this in medieval Europe. He lived from 1040 to 1105. In the middle of medieval Christendom, just at the time of the first crusades, when Jews were being butchered all across Europe, Rashi is saying, one day we'll be home, and they all want to know why we have the land. Can you imagine? Ridiculous. It took 1,000 years. That's exactly what's happening today. We're home, and the world is saying you took it. And what Rashi is really saying is, understand, the answer is not military, the answer is not strategic. There can only be one answer. The only reason that a Jew, that makes sense for us to be in the land of Israel, as difficult as this is because I honestly believe that Hashem gave this to me. And I want you to understand it's true for all the relationships in our lives. You find yourself with a person. When you're trying to figure out whether logically this is the person for you, well, let's see now. Now you earn 40 grand. And I earn 52. This is the person for me. That's ridiculous. Well, you know, I'm a neat freak, and she's a clean freak. We're made for each other. That's ridiculous. And you can reach a point where you say, you know what, I can't explain it. I don't understand it. But I know that this person was given to me. Then you know you've discovered something real. And that is our challenge. Our challenge is to reconnect with the real reason that we have a relationship with this land. Because as long as we as a people don't understand why we need to be there, then who cares what we tell the world? That's not the real issue, what we tell CNN. The real issue is, do we know what to tell ourselves?
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.